I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Welcome to Minute 46 of Season 6 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me this week, I actually have a great guest this entire week, someone who's going to be able to probably teach me a lot about this movie also. We'll have to wait. We'll wait and see during the week how that works. But my guest this week is Scott Myers, who is an associate professor of screenwriting at DePaul University in Chicago. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Great to be here. This is one of my favorite movies, so I'm very excited to talk about it.
Well, that's why I invited you, because I knew I found an article that you wrote about it. So I was like, hey, this is a person that I want to have on my show. So I'm very glad that you were able to make the time to join me here. And I am sure that I'm going to enjoy this week, and that everyone who's listening will also enjoy this week. So I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about this movie.
Great. Let's get into it.
Yeah. So Minute 46 begins with George having a query and ends with Mrs. Hatch starting a little bit of trouble. So we ended things on Friday with George showing up. I mean, he's at the Hatch house, and he's sitting there with Mary, and they're looking at the picture. We have the needlepoint of George lassoing the moon, and basically George started walking over to it, and as he was walking over to it, the minute cut off. So today we basically start off with that point. So George is there, and he's looking at the needlepoint, and his first reaction is, what's that? You know.
Well, looking at it from like a screenwriter's perspective, this scene is so critical, because it absolutely moves the plot in a fundamentally different direction. It's like, that's the point of the scene as far as the screenwriter is concerned, the filmmakers. I should mention the screenwriters are Francis Goodrich and Albert Hackett, and then Frank Capra. But they've got to get...
And Joe Sterling?
Swirling, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. They got to get the couple together, but at the beginning of the scene, they are in completely divergent emotional states of being, where she's excited to see him and he's not at all.
Right. I mean, but I would say on the one hand, he's not necessarily excited to see her, but he still went over there. Meaning that he does have some desire to see Mary, maybe not on the same level that she has a desire to see him. But yeah, I don't think he's just, you know, trying to placate his mother, who says that he should go over there. There's more to it.
Yeah, well, that gets into this interesting dynamic about what do you want and what do you need. And of course, what do you want is actually like a question that comes up in this conversation.
Correct.
But what does he need? And that's this thing that's inside him. You know, he wants to escape Bedford Falls. He wants to go see the world. He wants to build skyscrapers and bridges. But what does he need? And he needs community and home.
And an anchor.
And a place. And an anchor. And that's what we see here. The want is like, I don't want to necessarily be here, but the need is drawing him through this scene and why it ends up the way that it does.
Right. That's very true. I mean, that's basically the way the whole movie is. You know, the whole lay of the want and the need. George wants to get out of Bedford Falls from the minute this movie begins till the minute it ends. Or sorry, until 5 minutes before it ends. But you know, he also realizes on some level that he still does need it, even though it's once. I mean, I think that's a great way of putting it. The conflict that George has between his wants and his needs. So.
Yeah, and that's one of the most impressive things about the story. You know, typically from a screenwriting perspective, they talk about a an active protagonist, a proactive protagonist where they've got a specific goal and they're going for it. But in It's a Wonderful Life, he's really more reactive the entire time. He never leaves.
Right. He just talks about leaving.
Except for, you know, with, yeah, he talks about it. He reacts over and over and over again to things that happen. And so it just proves that this whole sort of idea that there are these formulas that work, well, that breaks the rules, you know, in that regard.
Do you think even back then it was breaking the rules?
It doesn't.
Or only looking back?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, no, I'd say just generally speaking. I mean, if you were to float around the online screenwriting universe, this is like a big deal. Like the protagonist has to have a goal and go for it, you know, and they're proactive. And this movie is completely the opposite of that. He's reactive the whole time, but it works.
Right. I remember hearing once that Billy Wilder said about, I think, Apollo 13, that one of the best things about the script of Apollo 13 is that, you know, it's someone who is trying to fulfill their dream and they don't fulfill their dream, but the story still is amazing. You know, you don't feel that loss. There's still something going on. So I guess this fits in the same type of category, you know, where on the one hand, there's certain things that you want to see, but they give you something else, but it's still as satisfactory, if not even more, because of the way that it's presented.
Well, I think that, I would think that there's a universal point of appeal here. Everybody in our lives feels beset upon, you know, things come at us. We have to react, you know, over and over and over again throughout our existence. And so there's a way that we can kind of identify with George Bailey, this having this flow of stuff coming at us and we have to deal with it. And of course he eventually realizes that this is where he's supposed to be.
Right. But he's not there yet. It takes a while.
No,
that's right. It takes
scene. No, not there. That's why this scene is so important.
Yeah. Right. He's just like, and one of the things I love about this scene is that George is there, but he's still confused as to why he's really there. You know, he's walking around the room, looking around, you know, staring at things that are going on. He, you know, putting his hands in his pockets. All these different things that he doesn't feel that comfortable there. He's trying to find a way to feel more comfortable in this room. You know, maybe it's on a subconscious level. He knows that he wants to be there, but he just doesn't know how to be comfortable in this particular place.
Yeah, again, I think that maybe that want need thing is helpful. I mean, he doesn't really want to be there, but I think there's an inner pull. I mean, he's attracted to Mary. You know, we've already established that from very early on. This is the third beat in the Mary George.
Well, the first one, when he was in the drugstore, he wasn't very receptive. You know,
he didn't even hear.
No, well, obviously he didn't hear what she had to say because she was talking in his deaf ear. But, you know, like when she tells him she doesn't want any coconut and then he puts tons of coconut on her ice cream, you know, he just doesn't care.
He calls her brainless.
That's right.
He calls her brainless, yeah. And then the second one is, of course, the night of the dance and all that, you know, so that's where the romance.
Correct. But it's been 4 years since then. You know, you'd think that she would have been home at some point over the last 4 years, that something would have happened. You know, it's like we talked a little bit about this last week, you know, the fact that, or maybe it was even 2 weeks ago, where his mother says, well, Mary's home. And he's like, so, you know, like, why are you mentioning this? You know, I think part of the because it's jumped 4 years, they haven't really they never have to fill in what happened over those course of those 4 years between George and Mary showing up in town. You know, obviously we know that George worked in, you know, the building alone. That's what he did for 4 years while Harry was away becoming a college football hero. You know, but
she does mention that she worked in New York for a while or was visiting, you know, she had some sort of thing
during vacations. I think she said that she was there or whatever. Even though we know now this is also a vacation. I mean, the reason that Harry came home and introduced them to Ruth, it was, you know, it's the end of the school year. You know, he just graduated and now he wants, you know, here we are in the summer. And, you know, Harry is supposed to be taking over the business, but we just found out, you know, that he's not. And George had to make that decision that, okay, he's going to let Harry continue with his dream and he's going to put his on hold again.
Well, that leads to that great interchange where Mary's trying to break the ice with George as they're sitting in the parlor there. And she says, "Nice about your brother, Harry and Ruth, isn't it?" And George, like, very unenthusiastic, "Oh, yeah, it's all right. Don't you like her?" And George says, "Well, of course I like her. She's right. A peach. Oh, just marriage in general. You're not enthusiastic."
Which again,
about.
He's,
and he says, "Well, no,
he's jumping into, like, you know, he's reading into something that she might be referring to it, but she's not saying it. You know, like, where's marriage? Why has marriage even come up between the two of them? If they're just talking about, you know, the fact that you know Harry and Ruth are there. But you jumped ahead a little bit. Let's just go back a little bit.
Okay.
No, it's okay.
Sure.
So you know, as they're sitting around in this parlor. So George then goes and, you know, as he's looking at this needlepoint, he goes, "Some joke, huh?" You know, he sits down on the couch and he says something really strange. He says, "I see it still smells like pine needles around here." Okay. And, yeah. You know, my interpretation of that is he's referring to maybe, you know, a Christmas tree. Do you think that's what he's maybe referring to?
Maybe. Or just that he's been there before at some point. I mean,
no, but it still smells like pine needles. That's the thing that gets me.
Yeah.
You know, I was,
and then she
exactly.
says, "Thank you."
That is definitely not the worst part. Now, I don't know if you have it open in front of you, this scene, but when George sits down, if you look behind him, there's a picture on the wall that looks so much like Peter Bailey. And I went back and I tried comparing it to, you know, the picture of Peter Bailey in minute 31 right after he dies.
Yeah.
And I'm saying to myself, why the hell does Mary have a picture of Peter Bailey in her house?
Huh.
I mean.
Wow. I don't remember that. But
it's, you can, and in this minute, it's actually the picture has like a light shining on it. So it looks slightly different, but the way that the pose is exactly the same. It could be Mr. Hatch. I mean, we never find out. We never know anything about Mr. Hatch. The one thing we do know is when George showed up last week, you know, on the mailbox, it said Mrs. Hatch, which means that there apparently is no Mr. Hatch at this point. Otherwise, it would have just said either Hatch or the Hatch family or something like that.
Well, I wonder, even if it's an image of Mr. Hatch, like he may resemble Peter Bailey. It might be interesting that you've got this father figure kind of looming down over George.
That's right.
You know, in that moment.
Right. It probably was just a mistake, you know, that one of the production crew just said, "Oh, we need a picture on the wall." And they said, "Hey, we got one." And they just put it up there and said, "No one was ever going to notice that we're just putting a picture of Peter Bailey there." You know, nobody's going to be going through this movie minute by minute 77 years from now. Ah, come on. You know, I've found that, you know, in many movies by minute podcasts, and mine also, over the last you know, few seasons, we found things that are probably, you know, just there by accident because, you know, nobody really expected at the time that someone was going to be doing what we do. So who knows? It makes it very fun.
Yeah,
it's like that's the way it works. And then we can hear the music in the background. You know, she put the song Buffalo Gals on again. Which is it's funny that's the theme song that, you know, that they were singing when they're on the way home, and that's how she remembers George because of that night. You know, it's always going to be Buffalo Gals for them.
Oh yeah. And he sort of waves that off when he walks in, right? He hears the song.
That again.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That again.
Right. And, you know, I think she's doing it in order to, you know, maybe she felt very romantic on that night, and maybe she's trying to instill in him some sort of romantic feeling at the same time. But he's just not receptive at all.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Nothing at all.
No. It's like, from a screenwriting standpoint, it's great because you got two characters coming from two different places. She's excited. She's like primping her hair.
That's right.
She invites him in. She, you know, this is a big thing for her. She's excited to see him, and he's not terribly excited to see him. And so you've got the basis of conflict. And as I say, you can't have drama without conflict. And so the scene is set up for that to happen.
Right. And then, you know, then basically She says to him, "What's the matter?" And he goes, "Oh, yeah. Well," and then she decides at that point she's going to change the subject. And then we get to what you were talking about earlier, where she says to him, "Nice about your brother Harry and Ruth, isn't it?" "Oh, yeah, that's all right." And he says, "Don't you like her? I mean, come on, he just met her a few hours ago. Isn't it pretty early for her to already expect him to have an opinion, besides a very first impression of her?
Yeah, it's a little
I
quick,
just met her 3 hours
but
ago. And I've had a lot to drink since, so who knows, you know." And then he responds, as you mentioned earlier, "Well, of course I like her. She's a peach." So I mean, for me, I obviously I've seen this movie dozens of times, so I've heard this phrase so many times in the past, but like, do you know what the actual interpretation of the term, that someone's a peach, what it means? Do you have any idea?
Well, I grew up in the south of the United States, and of course peaches are a big deal, particularly down in Georgia and that area. I would suspect, I don't know the specific derivation, but they're sweet. And so she's basically saying she's sweet. That would be my thing, but maybe that's not accurate or not. But yeah, she's a peach.
That is very close to the interpretation. The interpretation that I got of it, definition of it, is that it is someone that is very pleasing or attractive. It's an informal way of giving approval to somebody. Yeah, have you ever seen the movie True Romance? Which was okay. So there's a point in there where Dennis Hopper, has just met Patricia Arquette, and as she's leaving, she gives him a kiss. I think I remember correctly, it was a kiss on the lips. And then he goes, "Yeah, she does taste like a peach," because his son Christian Slater had mentioned, that she's such a peach. And he goes, "Yeah, she tastes like a peach."
Oh, wow.
So
We'll leave it to you to come up with a comparison between True Romance and True
why
Romance and
not?
It's a Wonderful
Why
Life.
not?
Congratulations. That's
Scott, you don't know me
that's
well
great.
enough. I can make connections
No, that's
between so
awesome.
many movies that people would not think to make connections. I guess I that
That's
vast
awesome.
knowledge of so many movies. This is the only thing that's good for that I'm good for. Talking about movies. So, why not?
We're glad
I
you
am
do it.
too. I have fun with it. So why not? So I also looked up about the idea of the name Peach or Peaches or something like that. And I found a whole bunch of names of people that those are their nicknames. There's an American tennis player named Jane Bart Cowitz, who she was a tennis player. She was born in 1949, and her name was she was known as Peaches. So I was trying to find out, like, why is she called Peaches? Why is she Peaches Barkowitz? And I couldn't find any real answer to that, except for the fact that she had a sister, or has a sister, who was also a tennis player, and her name was Plums Bartowitz. So I guess maybe in that family, they just named,
All
they have
right.
nicknames to their kids, using different fruits. Don't know.
Well, better that than vegetables. Like, you wouldn't
That
want to be known as
that's probably true.
artichoke. That probably
Especially
wouldn't
you want people to say that you're choking when you're a sports when you're in sports. So yeah. And then I found like a whole bunch of baseball players and football players whose names were Peaches. There's Peaches Davis, Peaches Graham, Peaches O'Neill, Peaches Wallace. The only Peaches that I could think of offhand without even having to look, but then I found it on the list of a team, a sporting team named from in a movie named The Peaches. Do you know what movie I might be talking about? Or no, okay. So think of A League of Their
No,
Own.
what?
So one of the baseball
Oh,
teams, they
yeah,
were the
League of
Rockford
Their Own.
Peaches. Right. Which is based on a real team. That's a
Well,
real team.
just to, there's also just a little more contemporary is there's Princess Peach. She's a Super Mario
Ah, you're
character
right.
in
I
Nintendo.
see. I didn't think about that. I'm not a gamer, but not that I necessarily would call Mario Brothers a gaming person, but a gaming realm. But yeah, you're right. That is very true. I also found that there was a murder victim whose name was Peaches, and it was someone who was that was murdered in 1997 in New York, and they couldn't find the person's real identity. So they just called them peaches. I don't know why. It's very strange. You know, sometimes you look up things and just
that is strange.
Just crazy things. What can I tell you?
Well, Ty Cobb, one of the most famous baseball players,
right,
was known as the Georgia Peach.
He's I grew up three blocks away from Ty Cobb's house in the suburbs of Detroit. So I used to drive by there all the time. I mean, he wasn't there then, obviously.
That's cool.
He was long dead in the 80s when I was growing up. But yeah, I remember riding my bike past that house, and this was Ty Cobb's house, you know, in Southfield, Michigan. So, yeah. So, yes, I'm familiar with the Georgia Peach, Ty Cobb. I wasn't that much of a fan of the Tommy Lee Jones movie about him. Yeah, I don't know. They needed to make the character. They made him too mean. and in a movie, you want to at least like the character a little bit, or appreciate the character. And if he's just too much of a bitter curmudgeon, it's a little bit of a problem. But oh well. Right. So back to the conversation between Mary and George. So then after George says she's a peach. So Mary responds, oh, just marriage in general you're not enthusiastic about, huh? So it goes back to what I was saying earlier, that where's marriage come from? Like, why is she even – I mean, I understand why she's bringing it up, but it doesn't make sense in a normal conversation to jump from, you know, do you like your brother's new wife? And now it's because you don't like marriage. Like, where is that? It's just taking it from you know, taking that from left field. Going back to that baseball analogy there.
Yeah, I guess, again, thinking of like a screenwriter, you want to present that theme of marriage because that's what plays out in a few minutes. And her desire is she wants to be thinking about that. She wants to be probing about, well, maybe he's not that interested in marriage and that could be a problem. And then, you know, he says that line about, well, it's okay for people like, you know, Harry and Marty and Sam and you, right? But the reason his mood is getting fouler by the minute, and this idea of marriage, you know, Harry and Ruth getting married screws him because she's, you know, right? And so now he's stuck again in Bedford Falls. He can, because Harry's got to get a job with Ruth's dad's company. And so it just raises the tension and his negative mood, which of course increases the conflict between
That's
them
right.
in the scene.
And you know, so then he goes, "Well, marriage is all right for Harry, and Marty and Sam and you." You know, I you can try and read too much into this statement also. Like, why is marriage not something that George ever thinks about? Is it because he's still thinking like when he was a child that he wants to have a harem, even though back then he had no idea what a harem is? You know, like where is this coming from that George, that marriage is not all right for George? Because he wants to be free to go all around the world, but you can do that if you find the right partner. If you find someone, I'm sure you, just like me, know people who, you know, they found their other half, and it's someone who enjoys doing the same thing that they do, that they can travel all over the place or whatever it is. You know, is he just assuming that there's nobody in Bedford Falls that's ever going to want to leave?
Yeah, I think this is where 1946 probably has to come into play. I mean, the more typical, you know, marriage scenario is the guy and the gal and they settle down and all that. And so that's the way I always took it, was that he perceives marriage as a constriction, a restriction. It's going to keep him bound to the place as opposed to his desire, again, his want to leave. So,
okay, would you say this for 1946 or say 1932? Because this is taking place in 1932.
32, that's right.
exactly.
Maybe even more so back then, you know, the conventional perspective of the husband and the wife. Yeah.
And then, you know, as they're talking, we hear a voice from above say, "Mary, Mary, who's down there with you?" So it's obviously her mother, Mrs. Hatch. She goes, "It's George Bailey, mother. George Bailey." And then that's where this minute ends. I mean, it's a nice place for it to actually end because, you know, tomorrow that conversation is going to continue in ways that people normally would not expect from a movie at this time. And We'll have to try and we'll get to explaining that one tomorrow. Is there anything else you want to say about this particular minute?
No, it sets up so beautifully for what transpires. It's just, again, the sequence starting with Harry and Ruth at the train station to where this sequence ends at the very end of the telephone call is just a wonderfully constructed, from a screenwriting standpoint, a wonderfully constructed set of scenes.
Okay, great. I completely agree with you on that. So every Monday we have a segment called Capra Monday, where my guests will give their top five Frank Capra movies. So Scott, being a professor of film, I'm assuming you've probably seen more Capra movies than most people. Maybe. So it might be, you know, I've had guests that have had trouble,
yeah,
you know, getting to even five. But I'm assuming your problem will be the opposite. That you'll have problems, you know, whittling it down to five. So,
well, yeah, I did. I had to think about it, and I'd start with Arsenic and Old Lace. Yeah, number five would be Arsenic and Old Lace, which was great. And Cary Grant, you know, Priscilla Lane, Peter Lorre, who was later in Casablanca. It was written by Julius and Philip Epstein, who, you know, co-wrote Casablanca. So there's a nice tie-in with Peter Lorre, who was in that. But Arsenic and Old Lace is just a hoot. It's just a very enjoyable. Then I went to Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which had Jimmy Stewart and Gene Arthur, Claude Rains, another character who was in Casablanca. It had Thomas Mitchell, who was Uncle Billy, Billy Bondi and H.B. Warner, who are also in It's a Wonderful Life. But, you know, it's sort of anachronistic when you think about the way politics are nowadays. It's just like, could you believe that a naive, you know, senator could manage to prick the conscience of America? But it worked for a film from 1939. Then I went to.
Well, come on, it's Frank Capra. Frank Capra's movies are always trying to show people, you know, the little bit of good in the world can easily change the corruption around. So
I'd like to believe it. Then I went to You Can't Take It With You, which again, Jimmy Stewart and Gene Arthur. Lionel Barrymore's in it, but a completely different role than what he plays with Mr. Potter. He's like this really nice guy. That whole sort of business thing and the dramatic irony of them not knowing that Jimmy Stewart's family is going to try and, you know, take over this place. It's a really wonderful movie. And I was really a tough toss-up. I mean, I did end up with It's a Wonderful Life as my favorite one. But It Happened One Night is just an incredible film. One of the three films that have won the top five Academy Awards. You know, best picture, best director, best actor, best actress, and best screenplay. But that movie was, I used to show that in a college class I used to teach on history of American screenwriting. It's just a fantastic film. Clark Gable, Claudette Colbert. But I mean, those movies they're all great. You know, he had a really wonderful career and made some fantastic films.
Yeah. All right. Great. Thank you very much for that. So why don't you tell people, how they can get in touch with you, Scott?
Well, let's see. I have a blog called Go Into the Story. It's the official screenwriting blog of The Blacklist. So I encourage people. It's been there I've been doing it for 15 plus years. So there's that. And then I teach at DePaul University. So there's that. I have a book out called The Protagonist Journey, an introduction to character-driven screenwriting and storytelling, which has been the number one book on Amazon, five-star rated book in film and TV. So it's been doing very well. Has over 30 endorsements from professional screenwriters and novelists and academics. So those are the main things.
Wow, very cool. All right. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe to any podcatcher you might be using to listen to the show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. And you can find me on my website, movearoundminute.com. So, until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.